Hello and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap between what you believe and what you actually experience. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty. Thank you for listening. On the next two episodes of Restoring the Soul, Ryan Taylor joins Michael to talk about his book, Awkward Spirituality, The Divinity of Ordinary Life. In today's conversation, Ryan reflects on his spiritual journey that was awakened through joining recovery efforts in post-Katrina New Orleans. He now ministers among those many may consider irrelevant and has learned that wasting time with people is actually a worthwhile endeavor. Ryan's a pastor at Urban Mercy Church and chaplain of Network Coffee House, a hospitality house for Denver's chronically unhoused. Happy New Year, everyone. Thank you for making 2021 such a tremendous year for the podcast. Without any further delay, here's your host, Michael John Cusick.
Ryan Taylor, welcome to the Restoring the Soul podcast. We are here on the fourth floor of the West Jefferson Building overlooking Eeny Meeny Sushi, which I'm gazing upon now, and I'm thrilled to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
We have a history together, though we don't know each other really well. I think I met you the very first time when you were a seminarian working at Franklin Covey Retail Store at Park Meadows Mall.
Yes.
This is my weird photographic memory. Sorry. But like you were a seminary student and you were wearing a pressed Oxford broadcloth shirt and a tie, looking pretty conservative. And now you minister and work with the homeless and you're writing about your book, Awkward Spirituality, The Divinity of Everyday Life. Tell me how you got from that guy to the guy that you are today.
Wow. But I don't know if there would be anybody else in the city, maybe just a very, very small handful of people that would know that history of mine. Because now I pull out a collared shirt and a tie about twice a year if I need to do a wedding or a funeral that requires it. So
that's the only time I pull out a sport coat or a tie.
Yes. How did I get from there to here? I don't know how else to explain it other than the work of the Spirit, just continually providing clues or providing invitations, providing compelling relationships that, and really it begins and ends with relationships, doesn't it? So it's just compelling relationships that would continually move me in the direction of those experiencing poverty. And you know, if I can make one correction to how I framed the poor in the book, sometimes we give labels to people like the poor. And if I were to do it over, which I might edit it at some point, I would say those experiencing poverty. Because sometimes those labels can very much identify you or misidentify a person.
Interesting you say that, because when I was growing up, especially in the Catholic tradition, we talked about the poor and needy all in one sentence. And it was like, oh, those, let's feel sorry for them.
Right.
But as we know, the conditions of poverty can exist in middle-class suburbia. Yeah. And then the spiritual aspect that you unpack so beautifully is the spiritual poverty that we all have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a big part of what I'm trying to do in the book is show the solidarity, show the relationship, show the union of all of us. But when we say the middle class and the poor, were automatically dividing us. And so those experiencing poverty, those experiencing some disadvantage, those experiencing advantages.
I love that. I want a prayer request. I'm experiencing an upper middle class life.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that distinction though, because even before we started, we had some sushi together from Eeny Meeny Sushi. And we're talking about the dichotomy of black and white, rich and poor, but even middle class to those experiencing poverty. And so it's not necessarily the big topics that are other, but it's sometimes these subtle ones. And so thank you for correcting me on that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Or offering another perspective, because I don't feel corrected.
Well, I mean, you talk about that evolution from working a retail job during seminary to now being a pastor and a pastor in an urban context.
And not just a retail job, Ryan, but a retail job selling daily planners, helping people to have their best life now.
Yes.
And to focus, to put first things first. So this like perfectly strategic, here's how to live the best life.
Uh-huh.
And I was totally seduced by that, which is why I came into the store all the time to buy the next piece of equipment or planner to help me with my life. Like that's not a small irony.
Yeah. Well, I know this is a tangent and there are no tangents, but I had no idea about the dogma of Franklin Covey, but the idea of a paper planner and writing out my schedule in ink, I'm still doing that.
Nice.
So I was evangelized by Stephen Covey, and I'm still living out the gospel of that in some form or another.
Well, I went to a Jesus conference and asked Stephen Covey into my heart.
Did you really?
No, I put that under the blood of Jesus. People would be like, oh, you can't say that. But no, I was a big fan, and his stuff was really good, right? 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. One of them was begin with the end in mind. I say that all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that fact that you're still writing on paper, I'm envious of that.
Absolutely. It does something for me. But no, that was just one of those mini seminary jobs. I worked at Starbucks for a year and a half.
Which one?
And I'm too tall. I can't bend down far enough to reach the things that I need to reach to make a latte. I was no good at it. So then I tried to do the Franklin Covey thing in the Park Meadows Mall. Yeah. Yeah.
I was a fan of the black quad point pen. And for those of you without a video camera, I have one of the 2003 quad point pens made by Kasumoto. It's a Japanese pen. They were like $24 back then, but it has blue, black, red and pencil. And new listeners are going, what is going on this program?
Mm-hmm.
What Michael is like, he can't stay on track. Welcome to the show, and we're glad you're listening. All right, Ryan, please continue. And we're going to be focused here like a laser beam.
Yeah. Okay, where would you like for me to go next?
So you're at Franklin Covey, and you're in seminary, and you wanted to be a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened when you graduated that you went this direction?
Well, I think initially my heart was being shaped in a way that was paying close attention to those who were on the margins of church and those who didn't fit with the traditional, within the traditional, especially within the evangelical tradition. And so my heart was heading in that direction. And then the more that that God seemed to be leading me towards those margins, my life started to expand. My worldview started to expand, and some of that started to happen through traveling. I went to New Orleans post Hurricane Katrina, and just saw some of the negligence of the local government and the federal government and those who were very much overlooked in New Orleans. So that made me very wide-eyed. And then there was books that I was reading at the time as well. That same year that I went to New Orleans 4 times, I read Shane Claiborne's Irresistible Revolution. And then that same year, as I was working as a bivocational pastor, I took a landscaping job in which I was the only white guy among a community of Latino men. And so I would just found myself very, very tender and very, very open to those on the margins, those who are overlooked, those who do not have the same opportunities and chances that the rest of us do. And so that was kind of the opening. I would say even prior to that, it was the works of Henry Nouwen and people like that were cracking the door open. And then there was larger opportunities, like back in 2006 when I went to New Orleans, started to read Claiborne, started to have opportunities too, in which I was the minority in the room.
Some describe that as almost a kind of conversion, mm-hmm. a second conversion, a third conversion. And I was sharing earlier about in 2005, I was in Bangkok and I had some similar experiences where I wrote a friend and I said, I feel like I'm born again, mm-hmm. like something emerged in my heart that had slowly risen up that I couldn't yet identify, but it felt like something brand new. And it felt like somebody had given me a new pair of glasses to kind of see the world. And is that kind of how you would describe it?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's like once you see it, you can't unsee it. And then you keep wanting to take the next step If the world's much larger than what I thought it was, I'm just going to keep walking in that direction. And so after 2006, after that New Orleans experience, my wife and I flirted with the idea of moving down there. We were so compelled by that experience. But then I kind of said, you know, I don't really know my own backyard here in Denver as well as I could. So I started to explore urban ministries at that time and started finding myself in the room in which I was the minority, ethnically in the room. And I would drive down to these urban ministries from my South Denver home, you know, about a 20-minute drive. And I would drive down so nervous, knowing that I was going to be one of the only white people in the room. And I'm so unqualified to understand the conversations that I'm going to be hearing. And then I would drive home with an energy that I could only explain as an energy from the Spirit.
Wow.
That something is happening here. Something is being reconfigured in my heart.
Let's take a minute, and I want to reference your book because I really want people to read your book. I have a lot of books that are sent across my desk. Will you read this? Will you endorse this? If you ever need an endorsement for this book, I will happily do that. There's a lot of books that I'm asked to endorse, and I simply can't because it doesn't resonate with my spirit, and I try to be able to say something. But it's called Awkward Spirituality: The Divinity of Ordinary Life. And on the back cover, you say that the book is a quest for congruence. And as you're describing this journey, kind of post-seminary, during seminary too, but it's this incongruence of here's what I'm encountering out there and in my life, whether I'm landscaping or whether I'm going and serving or volunteering people that are a different color than me. And there's no way to kind of add that up and make sense out of it. So it sounds like this incongruence started there. And that the interesting thing is you've written a book, but you're not saying I've got the secret. I've cracked the code to this incongruence, but rather you're still on the quest. So talk about that quest for congruence and what brought that about.
Well, when you go through seminary, in a particular flavor, particular brand of seminary, I think you're kind of trained to move towards certainty, to know exactly what you're talking about and move others from a place of doubt to a place of certainty. And in terms of that idea of congruence, I think I began to experience and I began to think back on my life and think, you know, actually the moments of most tenderness towards the heart of Christ have happened in my moments of disequilibrium, where my footing is not in control underneath me, where in the places where I felt like an adolescent all over again. And that's how what I would call myself, as like a perpetual adolescent. It's been more congruent to move towards the places of awkwardness, the places where I don't feel certain, that I don't feel 100% qualified. That has been the place of growth. That has been the garden that's been well cultivated and ready for new seeds of new growth.
And that seems for many of our listeners like, yeah, that's true. That kind of paradoxical sense where we're least equipped. That's where the growth and the intimacy with God is. But it's so hard to be in that space. Like when you were driving down to serve mm-hmm. and you were the only white man, that doesn't feel good and it's scary. No.
We're afraid to lose the control we think we have over the life that we think that we're living.
Say that again.
We're afraid to lose the control that we think we have over the life that we think that we're living.
Hmm. One more time, because I'm going to make a t-shirt with that.
We're afraid to lose the control that we think we have over the life we think we're living.
So we think we have control and we think that we're living life, but this Jesus way is let go, relinquish, surrender, and I am life. It's not a belief system. It's not adherence to a creed, but it's literally this entry into life. And by you going into these places of uncertainty, and difficulty, that's where there's been growth for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You used a phrase in the book. You said, when things start feeling weird, that's probably where we're supposed to be.
Well, I mean, I can talk about it in the context of, so just yesterday, I'm in the coffee house at Network. And this morning, I found myself needing to journal out the various conversations that I had yesterday. And there's one individual that came in who's new to town, new to the experience of being unhoused. His name is Sam, and he's from Albuquerque. And he was so appreciative of our presence there. And he just wanted to rake leaves for 2 hours outside. I said, yeah, you can rake leaves for 2 hours outside. I'll give you a tip for doing that. Then you've got another individual that comes in that is in stage 4 cancer. And he's devastated about his life. And he's living on the streets with this. And so you're invited to hold that with him and sit with him and pray with him. And then it's one story after another that I am completely unqualified to fix. And I think in the book, and in the introduction of the book, I start off by this individual named Kickback. Well, that's a street name, of course. But he said, you'd better not be here to fix me. That was my first night at the coffee house 13 years ago. You'd better not be here to fix me. And that's, they want a mutuality. They want a reciprocity. They want to interact with an ordinary being that will just, sit there, and befriend them. And so, you know, that's, I can't rely on my seminary degree for that. I can't rely on so many of the books that I read. It's, you know, this is how the Spirit is shaping me. I'm being taught, a different posture, a different way of being by some of the, by those that are experiencing some of the wildest disadvantaged and oppressed, way of life in Denver.
You talk about in the book how the poor are our teachers, and with your phrase that you've qualified, that those living in poverty are our teachers. But you also draw from a lot of the spiritual mothers and fathers going back to the early church. Meister Eckhart, Henry Nouwen is, of course, 20th century. But there's probably one of my all-time favorite Nouwen quotes is in the book. But it's obviously that you've delved into the mystics and the deeper life of the Christian faith. So how have those teachers of the, quote, unqualified and the ancients impacted your understanding of God?
Well, it goes back to that control idea. I love having more and more knowledge that allows me to feel like I am increasingly in control. And when you're around the mystics, they're talking about this idea of nothingness and this idea of powerlessness and this idea of letting it all go so that you can have this blank canvas for God to create his art on. Well, with that in parallel with being around people who economically have nothing, and are on the lowest rungs of society, literally, that has informed me in terms of what it looks like to truly invite God in, to continually transform me, to be born again and again and again and again, is that spaciousness in which I'm continually letting go of what I think I've acquired, which has led me to a place of control. It's a daily inventory and evaluation of, you know, how open am I really to allowing the Spirit to transform me and to change me and to mature me into the person that I'm being invited to become. And so both the mystics have written down kind of a bit of an academic way of helping us understand that, and then an actual encounter with those experiencing poverty bring that home and allow you to embody it. I remember my first days spending time at Network, and I'd see various individuals come through that front door, and I would see one woman that might come through the door that might be a prostitute. And rather than seeing her as wholly different from me, the Spirit almost immediately said, no, that is your struggle with lust. That person is your struggle with lust. It might be more amplified and it's more out there. Somebody else coming in a rage, or, you know, with some sort of explosive bipolar disorder. immediately the spirit would say, no, Ryan, that's your struggle with anger. Mm. So there's no grand difference here. The chemicals might be a little bit different. The history, the childhood was certainly different, but you're looking at an image bearer. You're looking at an image of God that is a reflection of you in one way or another. Mm. So they're not that different.
Yeah. So I think I could partially answer this question if you posed it to me, but I'm not sure that it's internalized in me yet, so I don't really know it. I can imagine our listeners going, wow, this sounds good to be able to have that kind of non-dualistic perspective of, you know, that woman's brokenness is my brokenness, and the reason why I see her as different or him as different is because of my brokenness. The question is, how do we get there? And you can't pray a prayer. You can't just read the book Awkward Spirituality, The Divinity of Ordinary Life by Ryan C. Taylor, which is a great book he wrote. You can't go forward at a church service and get there. This is a journey, and it's a journey really of being humbled and then living and being humbled and living and coming to these places of letting go of certainty and letting go of the life that we think we're living. So, I mean, talk about like on a practice basis, what does this look like for you day to day, week to week? And I'm not saying, you know, at 7:30 a.m. you have your quiet time. How has this been formed in you, this view?
You know, that's a good question. And I would say, so right now I have two teenagers. Well, I have a teenager and I have a preteen. And one thing that I'm learning is that I need to be going kind of at their pace in order to be a good dad. So I need to kind of be a teenager at times and be with them. And I really feel like that's my theology. God does go at our pace. And so regardless of where we find ourselves on the spiritual spectrum, God is going at our pace. But we want to meet God there. And so it's a daily meeting. There's still sort of a daily encounter with God and that can be pursued through nature or through the simplest things. But it's that openness to how can I encounter the other today? And I think that started with asking Jesus in my heart as a fundamentalist, you know, at 9 years old. And so that's what I mean by God going at our pace. I feel like it began to be cultivated, you know, in the early years in that space.
Let me just interject. When you talk about open, and we say that in relation to spiritual growth, most people might think, oh, yeah, I'm open. I'm open to the Spirit of God coming into me more fully. I'm open to biblical, scriptural ideas. But what you said, and it would be easy to miss this, open to other. Mm-hmm. And God operates, I mean, the incarnation is he put on skin. He came in a body, and that Mother Teresa spoke of Christ in distressing disguise among the poor and the sick and the elderly and those in prison and those are hungry. And so I think that caring for the poor and the oppressed and the sick and the needy, that's a wonderful idea that someone else should do, right? And I'm being mostly serious when I say this, but a little bit facetious in terms of like I buy into all of it. But man, I like my manicured yard and I like taking my car to the car wash every week and, you know, wiping down the wheels so it's nice and clean. But my heart keeps being drawn to these spaces of powerlessness where there are people that are powerless, where they're more obviously broken. And I kind of have always, my whole life, go, these are my people. And I think that's why years ago I worked at a homeless shelter. And I feel at home amongst people that are a little bit cracked, broken, bruised, who are really acutely aware of their need. And I often don't feel at home around people that kind of have their life together. And it seems like you are really comfortable in that world of those that don't have it together.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm comfortable at all. I would say I'm I'm a bit more comfortable than I once was, but I still remain in a place of high discomfort.
So is this what it is like, I'm wondering, for my black friends? And I'm thinking of one dear man in particular who said, Michael, most of my life, everywhere I go, there are not people like me. I am other. And when he said at that particular time, I just winced, thinking, I have no idea what that's like. Even when I've been in Asia and the Middle East, I'm with people like me. But when you go to these places and spaces, if only by your educational, economic, relational, your clothes are clean kind of thing, that you're other and you're now the minority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I think it's hardest for an American who wants to be efficient with their time, and time is money, and we've been trained in that way. We've been very conditioned to make the most of our time and still kind of make a profit, even if we're in the realm of the nonprofit or Christian ministry world. I think we have to be confronted with the idea of wasting our time with Christ, of being very inefficient, sitting down at the nursing home with somebody who's lonely. And you're looking at your watch. You're thinking, when is this going to be over? And really, what is this doing in the grand scheme of, is this really benefiting? Is this really helpful for this person? And it's the same thing at network. It's learning to waste your time. Mm-hmm. Learning to, you know, quote unquote, waste your time. I think that's what Christ does with me in every moment of every day, is this invitation. Hey, come and waste some time with me. Mm-hmm. And if we can, a lot of that's going to require slowing way down and putting the whole efficiency thing, the whole productivity thing, what we've had in our mind in terms of efficiency and productivity, tabling that. And inviting Christ in and saying, I'm just going to sit here with this person and talk about the Broncos. It might be a revolutionary part of their day to just talk about the Broncos.
And it might just be revolutionary for you and me, as we're the guys sitting there, and somehow, not that this needs to happen, we leave with that sense of fulfillment or excitement like you did, going down in the early days anxious and feeling ill-equipped and coming home like, wow, mm-hmm. that was incredible. I sat and talked with someone about the Broncos.
Yes. Yep.
But you didn't discuss theology or apologetics or ethics or any of those things.
No. No.
It makes me think of there's a Dave Matthews song called Wasting Time that was on about 15 years ago. And it's really a song about two lovers and their joy of being together, just wasting time, but how it feels so extravagant, lavish, and inefficient and unproductive somehow. Yes. If we do that with God and as we serve others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really difficult to engage in ministry to those experiencing poverty, those on the margins, if we have an agenda with it. If the point is intimacy, if the point is relationship, then we have to be okay with nothingness, with a non-productive conversation, something that we think, man, that is really silly. You know, an analogy that I make is Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood growing up. You know how silly that is these days? If we turn on the PBS and we watch old reruns of Mr. Rogers, and he's just feeding the fish, and he's just putting on his jacket, he's just tying his shoes. But do you know how much that meant to children? Do you know how much that meant to your heart when you were five? But now to us, oh my goodness, that is the strangest. I mean, how did that guy do that for all those years? But he was touching children's hearts every day through the mundane, through the routine, through the very small ways of just spending time, with the childlike heart. I think that's what we're being asked to return to over and over again. And it's why Jesus referenced, come to me. If you're going to come to me, come to me like a little child. That's the only way you're going to get it. And little children like to throw snow and burp and, you know, make bodily noise. You can do all kinds of strange things. Well, adults like to do that as well. Some
For
of
sure.
us, yeah. But it's that so quote unquote wasting time, that inefficient, non-productive space, and that's where relationships are built. So you have to develop that what they used to call a third place, or that place where you go. That's why for me, it's nice to have that we have a place in downtown Denver, in Capitol Hill, Denver, where people can go. And the agenda there is to come and grab a cup of coffee. That's the agenda. We have free coffee. And then you sit down at a table, you can read your newspaper, you can have a conversation, or you can play a game of chess or whatever.
Wait, there's no Bible tracts that you're giving out, or no gospel presentation?
When those show up at our place, they go immediately into the trash bin. Yeah.
And some people may struggle with that, but that it was Francis of Assisi who is alleged to have said, preach the gospel at all times, use words when necessary. Mm-hmm. But you know, you're being Jesus instead of proclaiming Jesus with words.
Yeah, and let me redeem that throwing away the gospel tract thing real quick. Even when caseworkers come in that have the agenda of trying to find some of our people housing, even that puts them off because it's one more person trying to that has an agenda with me, that's trying to get me to go somewhere, that's trying to get me to do some. Who's here to just simply talk to me? Mm. Who's here to simply listen to me? Who's simply here to be my friend? Who's not trying to get me into housing? Who's not trying to direct me to do the next thing? Who's not trying to direct me to get off their property? Who's here to just simply be with me? Just be a companion.
That's powerful. So powerful.
So thank you for listening to another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. What we're all about is helping couples and individuals get unstuck. You know how some people go to counseling or marriage therapy for months or even years and never really get anywhere? Our intensive programs help clients get unstuck in as little as 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.
You already know we live in a pornified world, but most of us are at a loss for how to navigate this sea of temptation. It's either ceaseless striving on the one hand or giving in to brokenness on the other. But doesn't the gospel offer us another way? The truth is that our sexual struggles are not actually about sex, but about a misdirected, God-given longing for deep connection. Dig deeper in my book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle.